This is class number 11, lecture 10 and 11, which we did not get to last week because of our electricity failure, got pushed things back. So the title is The Perceptional Context of the Vietnam War. And I should say this is probably one of the two most important lectures in the semester. The other being the one, I think, 2 weeks from now on strategy. Faire remercier, as the French say, to remind you of the context we've set in the previous lectures. Spinoza noted that definition consists in giving the cause or the genesis of a thing, that is, stating how it originated, how it was produced. If you have trouble defining a term, that means you're not sure of it as an idea. You're not sure about its essence. In that failure to define lies a clue as to the engendering of a crisis in perception, which the Vietnam War was, beginning to end. Not only engendered a crisis in perception, but it engendered all the subsequent difficulties. A number of tombstone inscriptions that can be engraved for the Americans in Vietnam, but one of them is that we did not understand the war, did not define it correctly, and therefore we developed a crisis in perception of it. We think in terms of words and terms. And if the definitions are fuzzy, so must be our thinking. And soon the problem becomes ontological. We're wallowing in a kind of metaphysics of nature of existence. Just again to remind you. Future historians of the Vietnam War may well echo Lord Palmerston's dictum about the involved Schleswig-Holstein problem of his day. He said that there were three people who understood its background. One of them had died, one of them had gone mad, and he, Lord Palmerston, had forgotten. What we're concerned with here today in this lecture are the many, the various, and the contradictory perceptions of the Vietnam War. Let me say just a bit about the word perception. In psychological terms, perception can exist on two levels. The first is to take cognizance of something, to see it, to discern, to observe by means of sensory stimulus, such as the eyes or the ears. The second is a structuring process, the organization of phenomena into a single unified meaning, that is a way of looking at them. This is the way the psychologists define perception. That is, you appreciate it in intellectual terms or intuitively, and you see it as an integrated entity, and you see it with the mind rather than with the senses. Often the metaphor of a Christmas tree is used in this explanation. You take a box of lights, ornaments, tinsel, and so on, you hang them on a Christmas tree. Now that is a perceptional act. Truth or error can exist on the first level I was talking about, but not on this second. I mean, there it's the term misperception. You misperceive something. But it has very little meaning on the second level, because there's no truth about the way you see a Christmas tree being decorated. They're simply just competing perceptions of it. Therefore, remember what we're dealing with here is not truth, only with perception. That's a major caution. There's a second caution. Perception in actuality is unitary, that you have a single whole thing that you see, such as the Vietnam War, in its entirety. But it is unmanageable, technically, to consider everything about the Vietnam War in its entirety at a single moment. Hence, the subject must be broken down into components. But always remember that each of these components is intricately related to all others, and together they form a single whole, that is, a single perception. One other prefatory remark, and that is that our perception of the Vietnam War was and is conditioned by a broader question of geopolitical power. This can be expressed in the question, was the central fact of international life during the Vietnam War the concentration of political power by the superpowers and their ever greater war-making prowess? Did the gap between the strong and the weak steadily widen because of technological innovation? Or was the central fact of international life actually the dissipation of geopolitical power? Did those with the greatest military strength, that is the superpowers, actually come to find themselves at the mercy of those demonstrably weaker than they? Is it true that all that was actually left of orthodox notion of power was its arrogance? This is the so-called tyranny of the weak doctrine. The United States obviously had the technological capability of enforcing its will in Vietnam, could have taken a nuclear broom and swept out North Vietnam one afternoon, as one American general expressed it. But the fact is that this great power was only theoretical, hence it was meaningless, a power that would not be used because it could not be used. There was a further, an internal dimension to this tyranny of the weak doctrine. It was that individual governments in almost every country of the world, including the Leninist societies, steadily lost governing power during the Vietnam War, and most continue to do so. In the past year or so, they have lost it with a vengeance in the USSR and Eastern Europe, and yesterday in Nicaragua. This was the result, will probably be established, this process, this losing ability to dominate political control within societies. Probably the central reason for it was what at the time was called the cultural, worldwide proletarian cultural revolution, presumably began in China. It was a revolt of the young, essentially, triggered by an 80-year-old Mao Zedong. It spread to the U.S., to Europe, eventually to Eastern Europe and the USSR. It killed the imperial presidency in the United States, and for a time rendered the presidency almost impotent in terms, for a few months I'd say, in terms of being able to do anything in terms of external foreign relations. It killed Stalinism in all of the Leninist systems, and no government anywhere really could command as it once had. All governments lost some authority which enabled them to rule. Some lost their ability to govern. So it's against the backdrop of those geopolitical developments that we examine, and all of which were factors, that we examine the perceptions of the Vietnam War. Now, the war produced an astounding range of interpretation and explanation, did and still does. Most of this is permeated by stereotypes, by factual error, by social myth, by gross oversimplification, by historical fictions, by sheer hyperbolic exaggeration, and not to say ordinary, old-fashioned BS. This was essentially, I would say, because of the passion that the war generated. It also reflects, that is a verbal response to this, reflects a kind of modern-day debasement of language. This interpretive materials on the war had a second characteristic. Various aspects of the war, the respective phenomena, if you will, were and are held in vastly differing perceptions. Sifting through the billions of words and pictures emerging from that period, one is struck by the repetitive, almost systematic dualism of opposing viewpoints. What I have called, in some cases, the mirror image syndrome. The reflection of the of one perception of the war is reflected in a mirror image of it on the other side. A whole set of these competing mirror images. The perception of the war as a whole, and in most of its details, varied between the two sides and within each side. The North Vietnamese had one perception, the South Vietnamese another, as did the Viet Cong, the Americans, Chinese, Soviets, the Thais, the Australians, the Koreans, and the onlookers outside of this circle. Hardly any two people saw the war in identical terms. Hardly any two could agree on fundamental definitions of the nature of the war, what it was all about. The war then was a prison of competing perceptions. That fact is the main heritage of the war for us today, this general lack of historical agreement. Now, in teaching the history of the Vietnam War, this is, of course, a weakness. It's an impediment. I've tried here in this class to turn this problem into a virtue, that is, to teach the war in terms of competing perceptions, dealing not with truth about the war, but in the perceptions which were and still are held. So I'll try to set these major competing perceptions down as objectively as I possibly can, and describe each briefly. This examination is divided into four parts, which you will find listed on your scorecard here in the menu. Perception of the nature of the war, number one. Number two, perception of the purpose of the war. Three, finite perception, which is divided into 11 sectors. And finally, perception of the meaning and the consequence of the war. Those are the four categories that you find listed on this handout here. First level or dimension of perception of the war has to do with its nature and in a geopolitical context. There are three general perceptions here of how the war was seen in overall terms. First, the perception was seen that the Vietnam War was an orthodox war, a more or less ordinary, limited scale, small-sized Korean-type conflict. This is the Pentagon view. To a very large degree, I would say it was the Soviet Union's military academy viewpoint. It was more or less the perception of orthodox generals in all armies all over the world. Some exceptions to that. What it involved is what warfare always involves: mass and movement. Mass of men, mass of firepower, and movement in terms of mobility and maneuver. Getting there firstest with the mostest, as one American Civil War general put it. Mass and movement in warfare, according to this perception, is adapted as necessary to local terrain and conditions. Bomb them back to the Stone Age is necessary, because in a war there is no substitute for victory, to quote General MacArthur. In this respect, it should be noted that the Vietnam War really was, in effect, two wars back to back. The first from 1959 to 1965, and the second from 1965 to the end in 1975. The first was a guerrilla war, more of a second was more of a limited war, more of an orthodox war. So this perception that I'm describing now, this kind of Pentagon view, is much more appropriate for the second half, or the second war, or the second phase, than in the earlier period. The second general perception of the nature of the war was that the war was a form of social change. The correct term to describe it, it was held, was revolutionary guerrilla war. It was revolutionary in that it sought fundamental social change, hence was broader in scope than ordinary war or orthodox war. It employed guerrillas who, even when they were North Vietnamese soldiers in uniform, still employed guerrilla tactics. While in a sense it could be said that this was a war fought for territory and population, that is the South Vietnam and South Vietnamese people, its ultimate objective was establishment of a new social order, one that would change existing politics, economic systems, social organization, the entire structure of society. That is, in this case, South Vietnam society. Now, left sort of unsaid was whether this was actually the objective on the other side, that is to change the economic system, social organization, and so on, of North Vietnam. Officially, we said, and the Americans at least, said no. South Vietnamese never said no on this. I think there was a looser construct in Saigon, which in fact did, if not hope, expect, at least hope, that the social change that would be delivered by victory would be just as extensive in North Vietnam as the North Vietnamese intended for South Vietnam. What made the Vietnam War different, according to this perception, was first there were differing motives on both sides, and second that even in day-to-day combat, in the later so-called big unit war stage, it was conducted guerrilla style. And the important thing to understand here has to do with the mentality of the combatant, particularly from the guerrilla side, but not entirely from the guerrilla side. What you should understand that the mindset of a soldier who is fighting in a guerrilla war is quite different than the mindset of a soldier who is fighting an orthodox war. As I say, this primarily applied to the other side, the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong, but it also, of course, conditioned the people that were fighting them. They, too, had to think differently and had a great problem in many cases in thinking of themselves as, all the business of killing children, involving children who were involved in war. It was seen as unorthodox, improper, and many of the so-called massacres that developed in the Vietnam War were the result of this differing perceptions of exactly who the enemy was and whether he was in fact the fact was that a 11-year-old Vietnamese boy could be just as deadly an enemy as a North Vietnam tanker. But the mindset of the Americans, particularly earlier, or all the Allied forces, was that this was not proper, that you should kill women and children. And yet the nature of the war is such, as we'll see when we get into the question of strategy, was an integral part of it. So, but for now, simply just realize that you're dealing with the mindsets that are different than in ordinary war, according to this perception. I remember, just to give you one kind of example of this. This is kind of hard to explain, this concept. I interviewed a North Vietnam or a Viet Cong defector, and I interviewed a lot of them. And one thing that we were always interested in is why they would quit, why they defected, to get a kind of insight and a clue into what was going on the other side. Now, normally what we got was what we called socially acceptable answers. That is, I defected because I believe in freedom. I defected because I don't believe in communism, and so on. Socially acceptable answers. And you would say, well, yes, but that condition has existed for a long time. Why is it that yesterday you defected? And you haven't defected for 10 years. You know, what is it that, well, yes, there was some things that happened. And then you would get usually an anecdote that would give you a closer view to the reason why that person, you know, I got caught stealing Nook Mom, or some personal that was involved in. But in this one case, said, well, we were up in the hills near Nha Trang, and we were a guerrilla band. We were moving constantly, as we always did, never slept in the same place at night. It is very tiring to do this, of course, but it is necessary. And what happened the other day was we had been moving all day through very bad territory, tough territory, and just about evening, when we were about to make camp, and we stopped, a liaison plane, it's probably an L-19 spotter plane, flew along the ridge of the hills, you know, like 5 or 6 miles away, and fairly low. And our guerrilla chief, our cadre, said, well, unfortunately, that guy probably spotted us, so we've got to pick up and move and which they did for about another 2 hours to another location. Now the fact is, it is almost impossible for them to have been spotted by that, and the cadre knew that as well as anybody else. But what he knew was he had to constantly inculcate this notion of constantly moving, the guerrilla mentality, in which you're everywhere and nowhere, you're fluid, the enemy never knows what you're doing or where you are. All right, and so you keep moving all the time, great asset. But there's a very thin line. If the enemy is constantly on you and flying like that and spotting you, that you move over the line. You're not in command of the situation, moving here and there, out foxing. You're just a dog or a wild animal that's being run to earth. You move here, they come after you. Move there, they come after you. So it's a very slim psychological line, but it's a very important one. And the cadre knew this, that he had to inculcate this notion that we're in command, we can control whether we fight or not fight. But from this Vietnamese individual's viewpoint, it was simply that he had shifted over, that we're not in control here at all. We're just being run to earth, like a pack of hounds run a fox to earth. And it slipped over the edge, and that was why he defected. But the point of this is simply that that kind of thinking wouldn't exist to an Orthodox soldier in an Orthodox army. He doesn't see the war that way. He doesn't think in these terms. He's got a rear, he's got a line, he's got a safe base. The enemy is there, and the safety is here. In the guerrilla, the enemy is everywhere. You can turn this to your advantage because you're everywhere and nowhere. But you can move over the line, and the mindset then is entirely different. It's an extremely important principle in understanding the Vietnam War. Now, some regarded this second perception of the war as having a third characteristic, that it was imported from North Vietnam, or China, some people argue. Others asserted that it was essentially indigenous to South Vietnam. We'll go into this in more detail later, because the perception of that really does change, I mean, the factual change from beginning to end of the war. There is some semantic trouble here with this revolutionary guerrilla war notion, namely that revolution is defined as the overthrow of one government or rule and the substitution of another by the governed. And so part of this first, was this being overthrown by the governed in South Vietnam, or was it imported by revolution from North Vietnam? Also, with the advent of large numbers of North Vietnamese troops after 1965, then the ordinary definition of revolutionary guerrilla war does not apply. I mean, it is neither revolutionary nor a revolt by the governed in that sense. That's why most historians, you know, say that the war was two wars back to back. Now, the third perception of the nature of the Vietnam War was that it was a new thing on the world scene, most commonly called People's War, Armed Political Struggle, Dao Chan, as in Vietnamese, as we'll see next week. It was new in history, and it was different because of its breadth of definition, because it erased entirely the line between military and civilian, between war and politics, between combatant and non-combatant. The essence was a trinity of organization, mobilization, and motivation in the context of protracted conflict. So it was a kind of war that invaded the political sector. It became politics with guns. It was something not just new in degree, but new in kind. It was the new face of war. It was not revolutionary, according to this third perception, in the orthodox sense, because it was a strategy. It was not an ideology. It could be fought by guerrillas or a regular army, and in fact it could resemble, and did resemble, it was argued, a small-scale orthodox war of maneuver. We have seen in the earlier lectures how this concept began really with Napoleon. It is a product of technology. inventions, application of technology to warfare, and it's by the ever-broadening definition of warfare itself, of what constitutes legitimate or non-legitimate warfare. All right, the first level of perception, then, is the nature of the war. The second has to do with the perceived purposes of the war. Why was it fought? What did each side expect to get out of it? Now, the overarching division here, at least in the U.S., is an ongoing great debate which marks U.S. foreign policy, U.S. activities abroad in any sense, generally labeled idealism versus realism in foreign policy. It's an old debate for us. It began with George Washington and his critics. It's continued unbroken down through history to the present time. When I was an undergraduate here at Cal and was in debate, this was what we were debating the whole year, realism versus idealism in foreign policy. And if you're on the debate team, you know, you have to argue both sides. So you get to the point where you convince yourself that both sides are correct. Just depends on which side you're arguing that day. But it is an unresolved argument. How do you define our national interests? Is it sort of narrow realpolitik, or is it a broader idealistic? And is human rights an integral part of foreign policy, or isn't it? And there isn't any real right or wrong answer. It is very much a question of perception. All sides in the Vietnam War, of course, defined the war in moral terms. Well, everybody does in every war, all through history. Both sides claim that our side is the right side, it's God's side, it's God is on our side. I mean, in the good old days, all the contending armies, if it's not God, it's Allah, or some divine being, says that we are the good guys and they are the bad guys. So that there's nothing too different about this. But within this, then, the more precisely in the case of the Vietnam War, there were these contending perceptions. One side, it was seen as a war to preserve the right of self-determination and establish the freedom of the South Vietnamese people. The war was seen as a contest between the open societies and the closed societies. Between freedom and tyranny. The United States had an obligation as part of its global interest in and commitment to the cause of individual liberty to make a contribution. South Vietnam might not be a democracy, it was argued, but if it could remain non-communist and given peace, a fully representative government might emerge. But loss of personal liberty was certain and irreversible if it went communist. That perception was held by most South Vietnamese and, at least in the early years, by most Americans. On the other side, in Hanoi and in the Viet Cong ranks, as well as throughout the socialist world, the purpose of the war was seen as unification of North and South Vietnam under the Hanoi banner. Unification of North and South Vietnam under Hanoi's banner. Now that required first that they drive out the Americans and then liberate the country. The unification was seen in value-laden objectives. That is, with unification would come justice and economic development and a diminution of exploitive foreign controls. In any event, unification was seen as the moral rationale of the war. North and South Vietnam are one, was Hanoi's official slogan for the war. Unification was seen not simply as some kind of state or party task. It was a kind of holy crusade, something Ho Chi Minh had been trying to achieve since the Versailles Treaty. Many indigenous southern Vietnamese in the Viet Cong, the National Liberation Front, interpreted unification as a federated arrangement in which the NLF would have a monopoly of political party in the South, political power. Thus they, the Viet Cong, saw the war in terms of justice, economic opportunity, absence of foreign influence, and similar values. some in the South and some outsiders, particularly the French, perceived Hanoi's willingness to accept a progressive government in the South, one independent of Hanoi, although allied to it in some confederated form. But because of geographic regionalism, there were many NLF or Viet Cong who were quite strongly opposed to the idea of unification. What they wanted was the political power for the front and some kind of an arrangement, governing and shared arrangement with the North, but they didn't. Unification to them meant more of those Northerners down here than we've got now, and that was already too many. It was a kind of tricky, I was really impressed in doing analysis, propaganda analysis, through the war, how the North Vietnamese managed to finesse this. In the North, this was, unification was a great holy cause. It was a great crusade. The newspapers in Yonsan every day would have editorials about it and articles about it. Every speech that Ho or anybody else ever made always said, unification is our great cause. You know, it is the name of the game. If you want to know what the name of the game is, it's unification. Now, this was not said in the South in the Viet Cong ranks, even by Northerners in the South. And so when we would talk to defectors and prisoners and so on, I would bring up this question at your Kim Tao, the self-criticism meetings or the indoctrination meetings. Do they bring up the question of unification? So, well, yes, they do. Although they say this is a long-range plan. This is, I mean, you shouldn't really worry about it, because unification is something that will come maybe.